Hey, folks.
Hello.
My name is Ellen Adair.
And I am Eric Gildy.
And welcome to Take Me Into the Ballgame.
Yeah.
In an effort to bring the entire Take Me Into the Ballgame project into one feed, we are going to be releasing our old episodes on Pitcher List week by week.
Yes. Enjoy for the first time or revisit an old favorite.
And so now, this is one of them. Hey, folks.
Hello, hello.
And welcome to Take Me Into the Ballgame.
Hey, take me into the ballgame.
Nice. I don't know if it's like totally appropriate for this film, but in general, I like it.
I think it is appropriate to do this as opposed to something that is appropriate for the film.
Yes, yes. Very fair point.
In a manner of speaking.
In a manner of speaking. My name is Ellen Adair.
And I am Eric Gildy.
And we are two actors who starved for Major League Baseball, decided that we would watch a bunch of baseball movies, and then decided that we would talk about them on a podcast, and then we decided that we would rank them on the 20 to 80 scouting scale used for baseball prospects.
And you know what? That's what we did. We made a plan, and we stuck to it.
And we are sticking to it. You are witnessing the stick-to-itiveness.
Oh, yeah, baby. We can stick to it. With a plan.
I love it when you just repeat the thing.
Yeah, but with a different kind of energy, I repeat the thing.
I genuinely really like it. So this week we are talking about Million Dollar Arm.
Million Dollar Arm. Still reeling after my wonderful mic technique, I'm assuming.
I just knew you were going to repeat it after I said it.
It's what I do. It's my thing, babe.
Oh, God. This is the best laugh I've had all week.
So, yes. This particular film, Million Dollar Arm, I'm leaning into it now. This is a 2014
film. We're totally
sober,
by the way, you guys.
We are, and yes. How. So this is actually the most recent film that we have done so far in the podcast. 2014, directed by Craig Gillespie, who has done such movies as Lars and the Real Girl. He did the Fright Night remake, which is pretty cool. That's in that Ellen's not going to watch with me genre.
Not going to watch it.
Directed I, Tonya.
I loved that movie.
Yeah, it was fun. And the young Cruella De Vil movie, Cruella, which is coming out next year. The screenplay is by Tom McCarthy, who is so good. He's an incredible writer, director, and sometimes actor who's made some movies that I just absolutely adore. The Station Agent, The Visitor, Win-Win, Spotlight. He also contributed to the screenplay for Up. So aside from his own writer-director projects, he has done something, a number of things for Disney, actually. This might have been one of the earlier ones, but I know that he also did the Christopher Robin film.
Oh, interesting.
And I guess Up was before then, but that's really cool. The film stars Don Draper himself, Mr. John Hammyham, as J.B. Bernstein, who is a sports agent in desperate need of new clients. Really trying to pull his agency out of a tailspin, having lost all of the old awesome clients, and he gets it in his head that he should go and find some potential pitching talent in India, a country known for many things, but known also for its cricket fandom. So he thinks that maybe he can find a cricket bowler who can be a major league pitcher. And it also stars Suraj Sharma as Rinku Singh, one of the pitchers that is found. He's probably most famous to American audiences for playing the lead in Ang Lee's The Life of Pi, though he also has made a mark on TV as Ayan Ibrahim on season 4 of Homeland, as well as Rakesh Singh on God Friended Me. Madhur Mittal plays Dinesh Patel, who's probably best known for playing Salim in Slumdog Millionaire, Dev Patel's gangster older brother, and a lot of other great people in this film.
Yes.
Got Lake Bell, you've got Bill Paxton.
Alan Arkin,
and Si Ma, who plays Chang, who's mm-hmm. just like in all kinds of things. And yeah, there's stuff to say, but I don't know, let's get started.
Excellent. So if you're not familiar with the 20 to 80 scouting scale for baseball prospects, the main thing to know is that 50 represents an average productive major leaguer. So that's actually great. If a scout can find a player that they think is going to be an everyday player in the major leagues, that is actually a very good player.
Oh yeah. And I mean, kind of relevant for this particular story, because what they're looking for is someone who can make the major league. Like, I think J.B. Bernstein would be thrilled if he found
exactly.
a 50-grade pitcher.
Yeah, it's very true.
And when those numbers go up, things get better. We got 60. That's better than 50. 70, that's better than 60. And 80, oh, you know that's better than 70.
Yes, an 80 is like a Hall of Fame level talent.
Oh, yeah.
And then 40 is like, this person might play in the majors, but maybe not stick there. 30, probably not. 20,
boy, oh boy.
They can't touch their toes. I don't know. It was the first like athletic thing that I thought of.
The old touch your toes test.
Yes, yeah. But
first day of camp.
Exactly. So our first tool is amount of baseball.
Okay, I'm going to go 30 because there's very little baseball in this movie and really nothing in the way of games, really. It's mostly just the tryouts and practices. There's not even like a ton of practices. And the only actual real baseball that we get is a couple of shots when they're watching it on TV in a very brief sequence where the guys are at a Dodgers game and we see like nothing.
You don't see any of the like on-field action. You just see them very excited
yeah.
at Dodger Stadium, good. Which is a logical response to being at Dodger Stadium.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah, but good for them. They got to watch some baseball.
Exactly. We did not. Yeah, there's that moment when J.B. Bernstein comes home from India and he turns on the television and he watches baseball and he says, "Hello, old friend." And I knew exactly how he felt because this was 56 minutes into the movie.
Ooh.
And it was the first real baseball that we had seen.
Yeah.
So like I too made a little like, oh, baseball sigh, like a Dickensian orphan looking at food through the shop window. But like, that's what we've got. And yeah, I have a precedent of counting practice as
sure.
baseball, and I'm not even against that precedent. That's cool. But I'm not going to count any of the searching for the pitchers as baseball until they are specifically training in baseball throwing motion, which there's this wonderful shot where like 60 guys are simultaneously practicing their throwing motion, and I was like, sign me up for the Bollywood video where it's 60 guys in synchronized throwing motions intercut with the heroine like peeking coyly from outside of a tree.
Oh, that's cool. Gosh, I wonder, I bet there's at least one Bollywood baseball movie.
Oh, we should look that up.
That is something to investigate. If
yes.
you know of one or especially a good one, please let us know.
Please let us know, gentle listener.
Yeah.
But mostly until that point, I'm not counting it as baseball. It sets up a dangerous precedent. Like if any kind of athletics counts towards amount of baseball, then like we've got to also count the basketball game in this movie, which we see a basketball game.
Yeah.
Or you've got to like count the football game in the Jackie Robinson story. And then all of a sudden we are going to be scoring amount of baseball in like Britney runs a marathon. And I don't want to do that. So 30. Basically, yeah. I agree with you. I mean, I gave Pride of the Yankees a 40, and it definitely has less baseball than that. Like, I don't even know what the 2019 player comp would be for the amount of baseball in this movie. Like, yeah. What's something that you waited for a long time, and then there wasn't even that much of it, even though it wasn't bad? Like, maybe Carter Keyboom? That's my best attempt.
Yeah. Yeah. Jed Lowry's like 2 days of spring training before he left and never came back.
Yeah. I feel like it's maybe slightly better than Jed Lowry. Like, there's still promise, but
he'll get out of that brace one day.
They're both good comps. So our next tool is baseball accuracy.
Yes.
And this is tough since there's so little actual baseball. But I do think that our two athletes like have plausible deliveries, and that's helpful.
They do, yeah.
Yeah, and there's plenty that it gets right, but it's such a small sample size of baseball. It's like a reliever having a bad inning early in the season. So I'm going to go 45.
Okay. I'm at 50 for the same reason.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. It feels almost like a neutral call. Like, what's there is fine, but it's hard to be overly celebratory or critical of it. It's sort of like we were talking before the show, and I was joking that for a future movie, we should do The Silence of the Lambs. And with that, you could be like, yeah, the baseball accuracy is fine, because the amount of baseball that's in the movie, which is none, presumably is okay.
Yeah, yeah. There are no inaccuracies.
Yeah.
However, that being said, I do feel like there are inaccuracies in this movie.
Sure.
My main issue is that Alan Arkin's scout character is portrayed as being able to tell what speed a ball is thrown by the sound that it makes hitting something.
And like anything, because there's even a ball that hits John Hamm and he guesses it to a T.
Yes, exactly. Because when they are looking for the pitchers in India, there's not even a catcher there. There's sort of like a statue of a catcher set up. So like sometimes the ball hits metal, sometimes it's going to hit the net. And obviously, I'm not a real scout. Don't tell Jim. Jim is my scouting director. But I'm pretty sure that scouts are looking at like a player's arm slot and his arm speed and his arm action and whether or not his delivery seems clean and repeatable and whether or not his frame is projectable.
Yes, yes.
And does he have a good spin? And I'm pretty sure that they're not listening to the glove, because I think it's really more on the catcher's receiving to create that kind of snap sound than the velocity. Even if we're talking about always throwing into the same material. So obviously, yes, like a ball thrown at 30 miles an hour and 95 miles an hour are going to sound different no matter what. But mostly I just think that this is hooey and it's for the sake of a joke. And that's fine, but it's inaccurate. So,
yeah, I agree. I agree. I couldn't help but think about there is, and the movie does point it out with the help of Bill Paxton's Tom House, I believe, that cricket and baseball are just very different sports. And mm-hmm. I'm interested, I did a little bit of research on it, but the sort of notion that one could turn a cricket player into a baseball pitcher does have like some particular challenges. Did you look at this much?
I didn't, honestly, because it didn't seem like an inaccuracy in the movie. Like, I feel like the movie accurately portrayed that it would be difficult, because regards the whole premise, I immediately had this question about whether or not the arm slot would transfer from cricket, because they really throw like way over the top and they're oftentimes just even trying to bounce the ball
right
before it gets to the batter, and they like run to throw it, you know what I mean? Sort of more like a javelin player or something would.
That is absolutely true. I was curious if maybe even with the kind of much more overhand throw, if it could still happen just through how you deal with the like release point or whatever. But I
mean, I
think that there are
pitchers change their arm slots. You know, it's a thing about a pitcher that can make them more productive.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But there are so many differences. I mean, think baseball has a small strike zone, whereas cricket like doesn't really. Cricket bowlers also, they really play with the line and the length of their delivery, which has to do with, as you say, the fact that the ball bounces frequently. And there are different types of cricket bowlers based on whether they're bouncing it and like where they're bouncing it. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the spin on the ball is really geared more towards how it's going to bounce off the ground rather than dealing with like
late break or movement or something.
Having the spin affect the movement in the air, because also there aren't the same seams on the ball. So it just doesn't move in the same way in the air. And the distance between the thrower and the hitter is different. Cricket's further back. Anyway, we don't need to get too far in the weeds with this, but suffice it to say, there are substantial differences between the two that I think don't necessarily make it impossible for a cricket player to become like a major league level pitcher, but I think that it's very challenging. And I think it might have to do with a person's just kind of inherent athletic ability. And, you know, like Bo Jackson could play multiple sports, but like, I don't know exactly how the mechanics of his football game like helped him to play baseball or vice versa. He was just an incredible athlete who had incredible skill and understanding of the games.
Yeah. No, I was definitely spiraling out about a lot of these things as I was watching the movie, and then felt very seen when Bill Paxton's character playing Tom House said, like, cricket and baseball are two completely different throwing motions. And I was like, I feel so soothed now. But speaking of which, I was kind of obsessed and curious about Rinku's throwing motion, because it's maybe notable to the ability to transfer from cricket to baseball that neither of the athletes that they ended up picking were actually cricket players. I believe Rinku Singh was a javelin thrower and Dinesh Patel was played field hockey.
That's right. Yeah.
And so perhaps that was one of the reasons why they were actually better at picking this up.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
They weren't used to a different arm slot for cricket. So
it's a funny thing about how this happened. I'm assuming that it is a true thing. I actually couldn't find it, but within the story of the movie, at least, both Dinesh and Rinku actually dislike cricket, which is a fun little reveal in the movie as it happens after they've won the contest and are already in America.
Yes. Yeah, it's getting into storytelling, but I loved that scene where they're all in the van.
Yeah.
And Asif Manvi's character realizes that he's the only one in the van who likes cricket.
Yeah.
It's very satisfying.
So good.
Anyway, if you have not seen this movie, Rinku pauses for a long time, like purportedly a minute before throwing the ball.
Yeah, Alan Arkin has a joke where he says that they call him the flamingo because he is standing with one leg up and an arm extended in a very, I mean, it's a very javelin-esque pose.
It is, but I was confused by it because if you watch javelin throw, they do not pause in the middle of their delivery
that.
They run and then they throw the javelin. And so, yes, I mean, it's very impressive. If you could just pause in the middle of your throwing motion like that and then throw 86 miles an hour, that's actually astonishing because you're sort of not using the full force of your windup, basically, to get behind the throw. So I could not find anything about whether or not that was a real thing that Rinku Singh ever did. I even watched a video of him in the Million Dollar Arm reality show throwing, and he did not do any of that sort of like hesitation, which I was definitely like, man, Satchel Paige's hesitation pitch ain't seen nothing yet.
I feel like it must have been based in something, even if the film exaggerated it, but who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I wish that I knew, because my review right now is that it's sort of like Disney shtick, but yes, I'm aware that no proof of existence is not proof of non-existence. Like, that is what we say about God and dark matter and whether or not Rinku Singh stood like that for 1 minute before throwing the ball.
Yeah, they don't really go into why he does it. It's just sort of like, look at this guy who doesn't know baseball. It's not like, it doesn't seem to be a kind of thing where it's like testing your control and core strength, you know, because like there are pitchers actors. Like Marcus Stroman, for example, begins all of his sessions by pitching in super slow motion so that he can like really be aware of every little movement that his body's making. That's really cool. But like, obviously that is for a very specific purpose that is geared towards helping his form, where when he's throwing those pitches, he's not trying to throw heat. He's just totally. Like, he's just trying to get in his body, basically.
Yeah. So ultimately, and I realize this also gets into storytelling, but I ended up not being a huge fan of this because it was never explained in the world of the movie as to why he would do that. And then I didn't find any evidence of it. But I do want to say, while we're on the topic, that I just appreciated in general that people were throwing at sort of comfortingly human speeds after a few films that we've done recently. You know, because when they first are testing people out, people are throwing at like 23 miles an hour, 45 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And when they finally get people who can throw 85, I was like, yay, they can throw as fast as Jason Vargas. Woo!
She did say that out loud during our screening.
I did actually say
of
that.
The film. What you say, though, about this feels like played for a little bit of Disney humor, I had a similar feeling when they actually get to the camp at USC with Tom House, and they have no understanding of what a baseball glove might be used for, especially at that point. I feel like they would have some understanding that the big glove is used to catch the ball. Maybe not, but that was another thing where I was like, really?
I don't have it in my notes, but I think I read in an article that, yes, they were confused about what the glove was supposed to do and whether or not it was supposed to be warming for your hand.
Wow. I mean, I know that there was a major culture shock in general. Like, some of the stuff that I read, I didn't read that. I guess I do believe that it's possible, but I guess because it was played for comic effect, I was kind of like, oh gosh, I don't know. But apparently, like, when they arrived, there was like a story of like they went to go see Iron Man in 3D and they kept refusing the glasses, insisting that their eyesight was fine.
Yes, I read that as well. Yeah.
And also were just shocked that like beef was being served everywhere. They eventually, after the events in the movie, like met President Obama, and they did ask if like he lived in a hotel, I guess because the White House is so huge, which they ask that when they go to Popo's house to the party. And I wondered like if that was maybe a nod to that moment. Or,
yeah. No, I guess that it probably was. A couple of other little baseball inaccuracy things. So when the movie opens, you see some bobbleheads, which the first time I watched, I was like, hey, cool, there's Roy Oswalt and Chase Utley, yay. But the movie is supposed to take place in 2008. So it plays a little fast and loose with the timeline, given that it also depicts JB watching Susan Boyle, who wasn't on whatever it was, like Britain's Got Singing People until...
That's correct.
Yes, excellent. My cultural literacy is getting better every day. So I knew that it was an anachronistic Roy Oswalt only retroactively. I mean, it would have been amazing if the Phillies had had Oswalt in 08 and 09 and all of 2010, and maybe they wouldn't have lost the World Series to the stupid Yankees. And I'm not saying that I want to live the rest of my life as the person saying, that bobblehead's for a team that the player hasn't been on yet. But like...
You've got to say it in that voice, though, if you get to that place.
Yes, but I got to count it against baseball accuracy in a film with so little baseball. Like, Roy Oswalt is there in a Phillies uniform when he has not yet been on the Phillies.
Yeah, similar to that, it's not baseball accuracy, but worth pointing out a number of the things that I read about this film did mention that when they go to the basketball game, that there are a number of shots in that brief scene of players that were not active on those teams at that time.
Oh.
Which is not hard exactly to believe, but is worth pointing out that that is a thing that happened.
Yeah.
But aside from that, because there's not a lot of baseball, a lot of the accuracy stuff in the movie that I found was... people griping on inaccuracies for just like tiny little like dumb things, where it was people being like, that's not what the Papa John's uniforms looked like back then, or like, they're using the wrong version of Skype, and that kind of thing, where I'm like, huh, okay, but it didn't really ruin anything for me, let's just say
it that. Only registers for me when it's baseball and it's supposed to be a baseball movie, like for example when they're brainstorming about what to do and Ash, that's Asif Manvi's character, says that the Red Sox signed an 8-year-old, and I wanted to be like
right.
That cannot happen.
Right. And even in that moment, I was like, is this him being hyperbolic?
He's making a joke. Yes.
Otherwise, I had other questions where I was like, is that really what, like, did they really drive all over India for this? There's no shots of them like flying from like Mumbai to Delhi or wherever. And they went to a lot of different places, but they're just like, oh, you know, we got along, we're hitting the road tomorrow, and there are shots of them in a vehicle, but like India is so big that I couldn't help but wonder. I feel like the story that the movie told is that they just drove all over the subcontinent for these tryouts, but like, I wonder if that's true.
I don't know. I didn't do any research into that. Although, if you are driving in a circle, you know, or something resembling a circle, if you're like, we're just going to go to the next spot because you want to make sure to hit all of the different areas, then like, you could do that without any of your driving days being really
potentially
impossible. Yeah.
Yeah. I just imagined like, okay, we're going to start in New York, and then we're going to go to Chicago, and then we're going to go to San Francisco, and then we're going to go to Dallas. Like, it's still like, these would be, you know, long days.
Yeah. I have more thoughts about this, but I'll get into them in storytelling instead, cool. I think. So perhaps then maybe let's just move along to our storytelling tool. What have you got?
I've got that sweet, sweet score that Ellen loves more than anything else. The 65.
Oh, God. Not the 65. Oh. The scouts don't use 65.
She's
they
just...
They don't use it.
If you could see her right now, she's just so ecstatic that I'm using this special score. I think that by and large, the storytelling, with a couple of exceptions, is very good in this. I do think it has a little bit of a low ceiling for me, just because it does have that very slick corporate Disney, where it's kind of diluted to a point that like it can have the broadest possible appeal.
Yeah.
And that has some issues that keep it from being truly great, even in its best moments. But that said, I think the storytelling is very good, and I think that it is like super efficient and like very tight storytelling for the most part. So like, just as an example of the tightness and efficiency of the story, like, it starts, John Hamm is doing this like very Don Draper speech to pitch to a person. It turns out to be a practice speech. When the speech actually happens immediately afterwards, he needs $1 million to get this player on board. He like gets into the car. In the car, he makes a call. He can't make the rent. He's defeated. He immediately is with his partner, Asif Manvi, being like, Yao Ming's a gold mine. We need a gold mine like that. He goes and does this Susan Boyle thing, this very weird Susan Boyle cricket montage, where it's like, are they going to play this entire Susan Boyle song? Oh, no. Okay, it's an infomercial, the news. Lingering on the cricket match. Yeah, Asif Manvi brought up the cricket earlier. That's cool. Oh, God, we're back to Susan Boyle. Okay. Oh, nope. Cricket again. Oh, nope. And you see the idea forming. We get this ultra Don Draper mode of, I cracked this. Boom. We are introduced to the character. We're introduced to, like, the problem, the possible solution, the plan. Everything is set regarding, like, the contest, what would be at stake, a sense of who this person is. And it's, like, 9 minutes into the movie. movie. Like, mm-hmm. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's very impressive. And overall, I think that this is a very enjoyable movie, and I think that it's very winning, but it's also intensely predictable. The flip side of that, of course, is that it is very efficient and that it is tightly structured and everything serves a purpose. But I don't think I was actually surprised by a single moment in the entire film. So I'm going to go 55, which is above average, because I really do like the overall story, despite whatever complaints I may unleash in the very near future. Because just for example, to the moments that you were just talking about, my thought about that first speech was, direct address to the camera in a way that you know that the person is not on the other side. So there's like a reveal that it's Asif Manvi. I was like, I was sure that it was not the person he was actually talking to. And then players never get signing bonuses for signing with agencies. That's not an accuracy problem necessarily, because it is portrayed as like a ludicrous idea in the film.
Yeah.
But then also signing a player would not have made him immediately solvent. He's like, oh man, I'm not going to get that check for you. And I'm like, you would have more money coming in soon. You would not have any more money in your hands just because you had signed that player.
Right.
And then this is actually one of my main annoyances with the film. I found the scene sort of unbelievable when he's listing every other Asian country and not thinking of one of the most populous countries in the world that is also where his partner's family is originally from.
Mm.
And I found out later that the $1 million arm idea was actually Chang's idea, along with his business partner, Ash, Asif Manvi's character. And they had to convince JB, which all the more, I was like, why have it be his idea? It takes him so long comparatively to have the idea when like Ash is the cricket fan. Why shouldn't he have the idea? And it actually makes me kind of angry. Like, it was actually the idea of these two Asian American people, but we had to give the idea to the white dude. And I think that the movie would have been identically interesting if it was Asha's idea and he had to convince JB, and then JB goes to India and it's like, what did I get myself into? And I also feel like this kind of tweaking with reality, which I am not against in theory, it led to some confusion for me in the end, or it led to some confusion to me about why Chang has to say, if you give these guys another tryout, our deal is void. And I was just like, why? Why would that have to be the case if JB is willing to foot the bill from here on out?
Yes, I agree. I think that in that case, we are meant to believe that another tryout will strain Chang's relationships within MLB. I'm not saying it's great, but I feel like they do sort of hint at that and kind of hope that that's going to be enough.
Yeah, it's just, I felt also like there were some sort of unclear storytelling moments about like the Rinku and Dinesh seem to be improving, but they're not ready yet, and why Chang can't wait like another month. And there were all of these things that ultimately developed from having the person who actually came up with the idea in real life become sort of the antagonist that I just ultimately didn't love.
Yeah, it seems a little bit like a missed opportunity also, because I feel like there could have been a world in which this movie had Asif Manvi's character a little more active and advocating for the idea, especially because we have John Hamm's character who does not like cricket. He describes it as, it looks like an insane asylum was opened up and all of the inmates were allowed to create a sport, which is great. I think that's a good line. It's very funny. But then, like, you could have given Asif Manvi more opportunities to push back against that and really champion the possibility of the $1 million arm idea.
Yeah, I don't see what is gained by having it be J.B. Bernstein's idea when it wasn't his idea in real life.
Yeah, and weird for him to be the person pushing for it, but skeptical also.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like the storytelling actually runs into problems by changing what happened in real life, which again, like I'm not against that. I do have just a couple of other interesting facts about things that were different in real life.
Oh, yes.
And what's very funny to me is that I learned the following facts by listening to an interview with J.B. Bernstein. And he did not mention in this interview that it wasn't his idea and instead it was Chang's and Ash's idea. And I was like, oh, of course, that wasn't one of the things that you pointed out as being inaccurate.
Right.
Instead, he pointed out like that his business wasn't actually struggling, but they just had to portray it as such to make him sympathetic and make us root for him to succeed. And that his wife wasn't a med student. She sells airplanes. And they met because they had neighboring penthouse apartments. But oh, just to be clear, that was the penthouse apartment that JB bought because he wanted to have a place to take chicks while Rinku and Dinesh were living with him. Like, just to be clear, that's how well his business was doing. This is my favorite fact. The JB in JB Bernstein stands for Jeff Bernstein. He's actually like the ATM machine and PIN number of human beings.
Jeff Bernstein Bernstein?
Yes, that's what it is. That's Whoa. My favorite fact.
That's...
So the second time I watched the movie, I couldn't help but think about it all the time.
Oh my God, that's hilarious. I had no idea. I thought that you were going to maybe bring up the fact that, like, I was trying to find more information about kind of like the current state of Million Dollar Arm and could not find much. And actually, I saw that what JB kind of currently does is he's the CEO of a drone inspection company, as well as does a lot of like public speaking.
Interesting.
So there's something about this Million Dollar Arm program and the sort of signing of these two pitchers, but it doesn't seem like any other people have come through this program. Is that not true?
I think that they did the Million Dollar Arm program for a couple more years. I don't know much about the success of the players that they found. I do know that at the time that he was recording that interview that I listened to, he was doing instead a like Million Dollar Kick thing, finding kickers for the NFL.
Right.
But the interview was a little old. It was like around the time that the movie came out. So yes, I hadn't done the research into his drone business, but I don't know. He and Trevor Bauer should be friends. I feel like I mentioned Trevor Bauer on every single episode.
So you mentioned...
I haven't even mentioned Aaron Nola yet.
You mentioned... Well, you just fixed that.
I just worked it in there.
I just want to point out really quick, it's not an uncommon storytelling thing, but it is like an annoying one. It's so irritating when there is something in a movie where someone's like, oh, I get it. You only date models.
Oh my God.
And the person saying that is model beautiful. And actually, like, Lake
yes.
Bell has done modeling.
Yes.
Like, obviously she has. She's beautiful. And they don't even like have the courtesy of like giving her like a pair of glasses or like the things that they do like in teen movies, you know?
Where yeah, there's, like... yeah. Or sort of like a messy, I work at a hospital bun or something.
Yeah, no, yeah. Like she looks great from yes. start to finish. And that's just lame.
Yes, it's very lame. I mean, I feel like the lame romantic subplot, which is always what I call it, it completely lives up to its epithet in this movie.
Yeah.
Like I did not at all for 1 second buy the budding Skype friendship that they had while he was in India, particularly because the whole thing was signposted by Asif Manvi's character in that first scene. And like I basically had a lot of notes that were just like the letters UGH.
Right. And then like they also, they make it very clear. And then, and this is, goes into the kind of like what I sort of dubbed like sort of corporate storytelling.
Complete lack of surprise.
It's that thing of like, they will make it very, very clear and then underline it again.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing that makes it worth it is the scene in the car with the young Indian men after JB and Brenda have first hooked up.
Yeah.
And like their smiles and their like irrepressible delight in the expectation of the upcoming wedding is really, really lovely.
Yeah. And just to be clear, rather than being in like next door penthouses or like whatever the situation was in real life, in this setup of the movie, movie. Brenda in the film is a tenant of JB. She's like staying in his like pool house or something. And they, the boys, see him coming out of her place like in the morning. So it's like a like mini walk of shame, yes. Sort of.
The smallest of all possible walk of shames.
Yes.
I also enjoyed it when Brenda called him a class A jerk, although I was like, that means something different in a baseball movie. Like, do you mean high A or low A? And does that mean that even if you're a professional jerk, that you're not as good at being a jerk as the jerks that are in double A and triple A? But I think mostly I enjoyed my own internal monologue and not that actual moment.
That moment kind of upset me because, like, she's right, but I was a little bit like, yeah, but does she not understand that his entire career is riding on this? Some of her like, well, but they're just kids and like, who cares? It was just a cut on the finger, whatever. Like, is a little sympathy for his situation asking too much? I don't know. Like, people sometimes are free spirits except for when it comes to them. Like, what if he walked into her OR like eating a burrito and talking about the power of friendship? Like, she'd be pissed off.
Yes.
She'd be like, this is 100%. My workplace. This is what I do. You need to get out of here. She wouldn't be like, oh, you've taught me a valuable lesson, JB. And I think the direness of his situation as presented by the movie version of him is worth treating seriously.
Yeah.
So this isn't exactly me being like, the parents are right in It Happens Every Spring, but I had some twinges of like, wow, does she have like no empathy for his plight? I think that maybe she just doesn't know how much is riding on it. I don't know. It bothered me.
It bothered me a little bit as well. And I feel like it bothered me for two reasons. One of them is because I just felt like it was pushing hard the, like, he doesn't value them as human beings. He only values them as commodities storyline.
Yeah.
And I felt like that's not all that's going on right here. He can value them as human beings and, like, certainly has learned to a little bit more by this point in the movie. And it creates for me a false equivalency with earlier moments when I think that he is being very inconsiderate and I was angry at him. I was very angry at him for taking them to that party.
That was so dumb.
Thinking it would be fun for them. Like, as soon as I saw the party, I was like, this is a nightmare.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I'm not even from India and I can just look at that and be like, oh, I am uncomfortable being put into this place.
Yeah, that was a storytelling moment that I didn't like because I was like, what did you think would happen? This was almost akin to like the person in the horror movie, like going down into the basement.
100%.
Like, no, you don't do that. Just a few minutes ago in the movie, you realized that they could not be okay sitting in a hotel room by themselves, leaving them at a party with a bunch of strangers and like alcohol and the food and like all of that. Like, it wasn't gonna end well. It was also kind of muddy storytelling that it was like, oh, they jumped into a fountain that like we never saw. Like, it sort of described, I wondered if that was maybe like a cut from a longer version of the film where they're like describing the crazy situation that pulls him out of his private meeting with Popo. But what we see of things not going well for them at the party is completely unrelated to what they're describing on the ride back when Amit and Rinku barf in the Porsche.
Yes, yes, that is exactly what happens. And I also felt like as soon as we're there and we see the other agents, the enemy agents at the party, that he wouldn't realize, oh, Popo is playing me against them in order to get a better offer from them.
Yeah.
So the amount of different kinds of stupidity that he is forced to have in that scene also made me angry with it. And then that sort of the hospital scene is presented as like, here he is doing this thing again. It's like, no, he is concerned about the well-being of this athlete.
Yeah.
Like, these are not, these two things are not the same.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
The other thing about the ProCorp agents that are kind of lingering at Popo's party that confused me was Popo's with ProCorp. Like, the whole reason that John Hamm gets brought back in, I thought, was because he's sort of unhappy with them. And so in that case, there doesn't need to be a deal made, right? Like, doesn't he just stay with the agents that he has? Like, presumably, wouldn't that scene in the special trophy room have already taken place with the ProCorp people?
Yeah, I would count this this is perhaps fuzzy storytelling. Because there are those scenes, we see a montage of JB and Popo hanging out like at a bar in a number of other different
places.
At a commercial shoot.
It's kind of intercut with the practice of the
sort of,
kids.
Yeah, makes it seem like he's not with the other agents anymore. And is he with JB's agency or not? Like, it is a little unclear.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was just not totally a fan of that whole sequence.
I really didn't like that Lake Bell put ice in the scotch.
Oh, yes. Yes. That bothered both of us a lot. She lost points with us at that point.
And then later, John Hamm pours himself a scotch and he doesn't put ice in it, which is great, but it was Glenfiddich.
Ugh, the worst.
Blarg.
The worst.
I just had to say that. I know it's not related and it's not a major storytelling point, but details that gave me opinions about the characters, for
Yeah,
sure.
Like, I love scotch. It's my favorite. I can't even drink Glenfiddich neat. I need to add something else to it. It's gross.
Yeah.
But as long as we are on the topic of JB's journey to realizing that the young Indian athletes are people and not just a solution to his problem, I sort of feel like the first scene where we kind of see that start to bud for him, I actually really like that scene. And I think some of my favorite part of the whole movie is the entire sequence when they go to the villages.
Yeah.
I love that scene in the van right after they have won, when JB is talking to Vivek, played by Darshan Jariwala, and they're all wearing marigolds. I thought it was very sweet, and I love the sort of triumphal trip into town after they've won the contest. And I also loved Rinku's sad mom.
Yeah.
And as sort of a contrast to, for example, the mom in Sugar, who every single day that Miguel would come home would be like, "Are you going to America yet?" Who was really sad that like he was going to go somewhere else and that she didn't know what was going to happen to him. And she recognized that it was like a great opportunity. And it was a really lovely scene. And it also, I thought, well done the way in which his responsibility was starting to land on him.
Yeah. And that speech in the van with Vivek, was that on the way to
That's
it?
On the way to the villages, yeah.
That whole sequence did a really good job of presenting that part of the story.
Yeah. Although, it has to be said that while we were watching this movie, I turned to you and I said, wait a second, are they from the same village?
Right. It's a little unclear. So they were at the same tryout, right?
They're presented as being at the same tryout.
And they used to go to the same school, but Dinesh had to leave because his dad's back got bad enough that his job he needed help with. So Dinesh left school to help with his family. But I don't think they knew each other at school.
Yeah, no, they did not. And this is all made clear. But just in real life, I did a little bit of research because I'm a dweeb. And they are from two villages that are about as far apart as New York City and Detroit.
Oh, wow.
Just for context. And I'm not mad that this is inaccurate, but I'm a little mad that there wasn't a little bit more Marvel about, we found the two guys who are from the same area, you know? And then maybe be like, oh my gosh, it's because they went to the same school. Like, that is actually a thing where I would have liked if they would have underlined the storytelling a little bit, because it was very unbelievable that out of all of India, the two winners of this contest just like happened to come from the exact same area.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
But, you know, I do feel like the moral of the film is sort of expressed in that date that they have in their yard with like implausibly like, where did they get all of those twinkly lights? And where did Brenda get a sari that fits her perfectly? Because she doesn't live in Jackson Heights. We could go get a sari if we wanted, but did she go to get one? But JB says something like, baseball shouldn't be all about business. It should be about fun. And I was like, yes, thank you. Here's the moral of the story. And I see you. And maybe can we also get this projected onto a billboard for the owners who think that they are constitutionally entitled to make a gigantic profit every single calendar year.
Yeah, I had two main thoughts about that date sequence. Number one, I wrote down, yes, to remind us that this is a Disney film. I could think of like no other like real reason for it there. And like, so then that led me to think when there was this like, oh, you know what? Have fun. Like, don't worry about this other stuff. There's just something that I inherently distrust when a corporation is pushing a message like, oh, don't worry about the business. Let the business worry about the business. Just have fun.
Totally.
That is a little bit, yeah, it was suspect to me. Like, when people are like, hey, you know what? Let the front office worry about that. You just worry about having a good time. I'm like, yeah, why are you saying that?
Because it will sell tickets.
Yeah.
So, yes, that is actually the moral of the story.
The only other thing that I'll say on that point is that I did really love at the end of the film in the second tryout when Rinku begins to pitch and he does his like crazy flamingo, what is that stance again? And they're like, what's he doing now? And John Hamm goes, he's having fun. I didn't like that moment for what it was. I liked that moment because of the incredible groan that you made, Ellen, at that moment. It was like a little upset forest creature.
It was me, yeah. And that's even when the forest creature had been recently placated, because when we had our incredibly lame romantic subplot interlude right before these two athletes are going to have the most important moment of their athlete life, and then JB and Brenda have to stand on the side being like, I think I like you, Miss Brenda. And she says, I think I like you, Mr. JB, sir. And then Alan Arkin's character said something like, can we move it along here? And I was like, amen.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, God.
But I do have to say, as with other Field of Dreams where there are storytelling issues, I still got teary a couple of moments in this film. And one of those moments was in that scene when Amit gives Rinku and Dinesh the speech right before they're about to pitch. I definitely had the feels for him when he got his notebook taken away. I was like, I see you, anxious overpreparer. And it's really not actually a very good speech on a scale from like 1 to Crispin's Day, but he talks about the power of young Indian boys being able to see themselves on the field in Rinku and Dinesh, and I got a little tear in my eye about representation. Like,
aww.
It made me feel a thing.
That's lovely. One last thing about that speech. This is, again, an instance of the how can everybody hear what's going on? It's this intimate
totally.
Speech at the mound, and then it cuts back to everybody else watching, and JB is like, who knew? Or something like that, implying that they were all present for this very private speech taking place some distance away, because they're like on the sidelines. And it's just another example of that trope that I really don't like in sports movies.
Yeah, I agree. And I also, when we were watching that scene and Tom House's character said, like, here comes the doctor, sort of suggestively, and I was like, wait a second, how does he know who Brenda is? And you helpfully pointed out to me, like, oh, she's wearing scrubs.
Yeah.
And I thought, yes. And yet it made it seem like he knew her.
Yeah, there was like a level of familiarity,
yeah,
for sure. I think this is a slightly inaccuracy thing, but I don't know that all of that baseball dream stuff and like all I've wanted is to be like in baseball and baseball coach is true for Amit, who's also known as Dipesh Solanki. I actually have in front of me his LinkedIn profile.
Oh my God, please tell me.
I mean, it's a lot of different things kind of the same. Like, he was the founder of the United Basketball Alliance. He was the vice president of Mumbai Gladiator, which, that was the pro football thing, and has done some similar scouting for the WWE. So like a lot of athletic type entertainment programs. So I think the baseball thing might be a stretch, although like clearly he hustles.
Yeah, no, I really loved that character. And it was a nice moment for him. Like, it was a nice way to take care of other people's arcs and not just sort of the main characters.
Yeah. Speaking of inspirational speeches, how weird is it that Lake Bell, that Brenda, is like weeping at the end of the Pride of the Yankees? I don't know. That just struck me as a little bit strange. And she was like, this is the saddest movie I've ever seen or something. And it did make me wonder how many movies Brenda has seen. I mean, yeah, she's got long shifts at the hospital, presumably. So like, maybe it's not her fault. But I just thought, boy, even in terms of baseball movies, this is not the one that I would choose for like, oh God, this gets me every time. It destroys me. It's an interesting choice.
That speech is very moving, but it's not possible, I think, to watch, for example, the previous scene in the doctor's office and not be annoyed by multiple things.
Right.
Like those stupid pocket squares.
Yeah. Anyway.
No, I think I said to you at that moment, like, oh, she's losing some more points, having already lost some points because she puts ice in her scotch.
One thing that I thought was kind of interesting related to Chang, actually, I don't know, I've been thinking about this a lot today. So when JB first goes to India, there is a little bit of a culture shock because Vivek says that everything is ready. And then like, it turns out that it isn't ready. Like everything's here, but it's not here. And we need to not bribe, but bypass the system. And John Hamm, Mr. Bernstein, is like, this is unacceptable. Like we had an agreement, like we need this now. I've been thinking about that in the context of the meeting that Bernstein had with Chang later, where Bernstein wants more time for the tryout, and Chang's like, but we had an agreement. Are you not going to honor the agreement? There seemed to be some connection, at least in my mind, between those two scenes in terms of like, what he expects of other people versus what he expects like for himself. Yeah, I don't know. Just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, totally. I did not quite clock that at the time, but I think that that is a really excellent point.
Yeah, I think that's like a really neat little thing that's put in there.
However, that scene does get to a point that I had in a very small subcategory that I have here called India Accuracy.
Ooh.
Which I do not pretend to be an expert on this. I have merely been to India, and also my stepmom is Indian. But there were a few things that, even with that sort of like baseline level of familiarity, I was like, yes or no to. Mm. And one of them was what Vivek says about everything is running smoothly and on time. I was like, yes, this strikes me as an accurate portrayal of what would be said if things were running neither smoothly nor on time. And also in that scene, when he has the very funny line talking about honking, he says, Indians love honking, JB. I don't know why. It doesn't help.
So good.
It's so good. But I am not sure that I completely buy it, because I remember also thinking a lot about Indian horn usage when I was there as a teenager. And I remember riding in many vehicles that honked all the time, narrowing it down to three possibilities. One, you are on the wrong side of the road. You are in my way. Two, I am on the wrong side of the road. You are in my way. And three, this vehicle is equipped with a horn. And ultimately, I intuited that it was actually just a constant I am here signal, because there's so many different kinds of vehicles and animals on the road that if you are the daddy shark of that vehicular ecosystem, you need to let people know all the time, like, I'm a big car, I'm coming through. Rickshaws, ox carts. Know that I am here all the time.
Yeah,
I think that's like a sonar system.
It's like a big metal mechanical animal a la that Far Side cartoon of like what dogs are really saying. Like it's just the cars being like, hey, hey, hey.
100%.
Hey,
yes.
Hey. They might be saying it for different reasons, but that's ultimately what it comes down to.
Yeah. Conversely, I deeply appreciated the scene where JB is sort of transfixed by this Indian commercial. I think it's a commercial, maybe it's just TV programming. There's these words blind date that flash up on the screen. But I was obsessed with Indian commercials. And I still remember my favorite one was for gel pens called Ad Gel. And the theme song was basically get Ad Gel, get Ad Gel. Over a kind of a techno beat, it was delightful.
Ooh.
When Amit says that he is going to get JB some juice, because there's a sort of joke about like juice being like speed in pitching.
That good pitcher stuff.
Yes. Yeah. And Amit is like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go get you juice. I was like, don't bring him juice. Juice is not safe for him to drink. Like, don't drink juice in India. It's not safe. And then my last point was when they have returned to America and Rinku and Dinesh are in their hotel room and he tells them to sleep well and he'll see them the next day, and they give him the Indian head waggle, and he was like, what's that supposed to mean? I was like, you didn't learn what the head waggle meant in all of your time in India? Yeah. I don't buy it at all.
He was there for a very long time.
He was there for a long time. You know what the head waggle means.
Yeah.
Which, if you don't know what it means, it's sort of like a gesture that can actually convey a number of things depending upon how enthusiastically the person is waggling their head, but it basically usually means like, I understand, like, yes, I've got you.
Yeah.
That concludes my tiny India accuracy segment.
Couple of little things that that I do want to point out before we move on. I thought it was so funny, and I don't think it was like entirely intentionally funny. The guy that Brenda is dating when JB first gets back from India, I thought it was so funny. So they're like flirting on their Skype calls. Ugh. Which is a little like, fine, whatever. Like, they needed to develop that relationship, but also he needed to be in India and she's not. And so, like, I understand kind of the necessity of that in telling the story this way.
Yes, but bored.
Yeah. But so when he comes back and is like, hey, I thought we were going to catch up over some scotch, clearly not realizing yet that she puts ice in it.
Yeah, he doesn't know.
Suddenly, this shirtless, impossibly ripped guy comes in, and it becomes very apparent that this is Brenda's new boyfriend. And he has just like the perfect level of like, ugh, when he's like, oh yeah, I spent 3 months in an ashram in Goa or whatever.
Totally.
But I just thought it was so funny because all I could think of is John Hamm is so insanely handsome and charming that to create a person that his character could in any way be jealous of, they needed to find someone who was like 10 years younger without an ounce of fat on him, sweaty and ripped.
Yeah, cut like somebody on the front of a men's magazine with like baby oil all over him.
It just like, I couldn't get over how funny it was. Yeah, like it gave me funny. The giggles. The ending of the movie has some sweet moments, but like over the credits we cut to these kids running around in India. It's clearly meant to show that the program worked and like they're thinking about baseball and like it's going to grow, but it can't fully escape this like corporate sense because there's like a kid who's like getting ready to throw a ball and the other kids are around watching him. And then you see that this little kid is wearing a shirt with Rinku written on the back, like a little like DIY jersey. And it's very, very sweet, but so much of the storytelling that we've gotten so far left me with the conclusion of like, oh, this is a good thing because soon he will be able to buy one of these jerseys.
Yes.
It had enough of that like merchandising like tinge on it that it, I don't know, like it spoiled it a little bit for me, because clearly despite this like, oh, suddenly things are okay when we think about it in terms of like having fun and not of business, like clearly this is all still within a web of business that is ongoing.
It's trying to put the icing of fun on top of the cake of capitalism. And we know,
yeah. Oh,
we've
that's
been
a good way of putting it.
Cooking that cake this entire time. Like, they were interested in this whole thing because they needed money, because they needed to save their agency, fictionally, of course, as J.B. Bernstein wants us to know. So we know that this is only possible because it is commercially profitable. So this dream of like bringing baseball to the subcontinent entirely has to do with like, yeah, like they all are going to want to buy hats and jerseys. I mean, it's presented that way. And so then to sort of try to have the last taste in your mouth be the notion of little kids enjoying baseball. I mean, I got teary during Amit's speech. And so like, yes, in some sense, the movie did take me there. But on the other hand, yes, 100%.
It's just hard for a movie like this made by the people who made it to have it both ways. And they're trying to have it both ways.
They're trying to have their cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
I'm only laughing about because I just made a cake metaphor and then I got to use the stock phrase about it. And I actually feel really delighted. It's almost like I get to have my cake metaphor and eat it too. So our next tool is score. I loved the music for this film and I'm going to give it a 70 because I don't know that it's necessarily iconic in the way that an 80 grade baseball movie score is, but in terms of me wanting to go out and actually buy some of the tracks, it is an 80, but I am going to be restrained and I am going to score it a 70. It's absolutely a baseball movie soundtrack that I'm most likely to listen to independently. And both times that we watched this movie, I literally got up and danced. And that's not even counting all the times that I was sitting on the couch, dancing, annoying my fellow scout.
So I am also at a 70.
Oh, hooray.
Yeah, no, this is definitely the score that came closest to perfect for me.
So, I love A.R. Rahman.
Yeah, he's great. For people who don't know or think they don't know this composer, this is the guy who did the music for Slumdog Millionaire, for which he won 2 Academy Awards. He actually received a 3rd nomination because he had 2 nominated songs, so he beat himself that year.
And also, I love it and I own it and I've listened to it 10,000 times on the treadmill. Oh, the treadmill. I miss you.
He also has received Academy Award nominations for score and song for 127 Hours. Another Danny Boyle collaboration, but he's got almost 200 IMDb credits and has been dubbed by some people as the Mozart of Madras because he's super prolific and talented. I think the vast majority of his work is in Hindi and Tamil films, but he is a huge selling artist. Like, he's actually, I think, one of the higher selling recording artists in the world, just because
I mean,
he's done so much and so much of it is really of a high quality. So much so, I mean, he in 2009 was named as one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people. And so that's cool. There is one really highlight song in this film that is a collaboration with Iggy Azalea called Million Dollar Dream, I believe. Spinning bowls, good enough to bring the winnings home. Now the top of the mound is what we're sitting on. I think it's a pretty good song, although I think it is very funny and appropriate because so much of her ultimate downfall came in part through this like cultural appropriation. And I feel like that's weirdly like a theme that is present in the film as like, the clash there just like seems relevant. And so even though her stock has fallen, I feel like this song like kind of withstands it a little bit because it participates in that very thing weirdly.
Yeah, but I mean, it's also the fusion of 2 different artists. I mean, it's A.R. Rahman is bringing his own music. And so, you know, there are also tracks on this with Kendrick Lamar and with Wale. And I mean, I just think that they are delightful. And yes, I think that cultural appropriation in music is sort of a sticking point to me. And maybe it's just because Paul Simon's Graceland is one of my 3 favorite albums of all time. And like, he definitely does that. And yet it's so good.
Oh, for sure.
You know, so yes, it's an issue, but at the same time, what it has brought for me is a soundtrack that combines hip hop artists that I like with Indian music, which I love. I love Indian music.
Oh,
like,
it's great.
I have also hit the elliptical machines with like best of Bollywood albums that are not even mashups.
Yeah.
I love Indian music.
For sure. For sure.
So,
distinction to be made though is like, you know, Graceland came well into Paul Simon's career. I think some of the appropriation issues with Iggy Azalea is that she is like a white Australian woman taking on
totally
American hip hop culture and kind of like moving to the front of the line and being like thrown accolades left and right. There's also like a history of weird code shifting with her where she sounds one way and then like another way when it's time for her to like be on as an artist, all while having a history of tweeting like just racist stuff. And it's really like a parfait of problems with Iggy Azalea that I think ultimately caught up with her.
I love the phrase parfait of problems. And to be clear, I did not mean to equate Paul Simon with Iggy Azalea. I merely meant to say that, like, I know that cultural appropriation is sort of an issue in general with music.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I've never really followed Iggy Azalea that much, so I'm by no means an expert on it. I do think that this song is good, though.
I
My
agree.
One problem a little bit with the music is just that lyrically it is frequently very much on the nose, where it's like $1 million arm for my $1 million dreams, and then like it goes to another song and it's like, this is destiny and I am meant to do this. And so maybe personal preference thing, but I think that a number of the lyrics to various songs in this film just really spell out what's going on in a way that was not exceptionally enjoyable for me.
That is fair. I didn't really hear the lyrics over the sound of my own dancing. So our next tool is acting.
I'm at 65. Yeah, I think the acting is really good. It's a super solid ensemble all around and like professional good actors who are really wonderful at maneuvering some of the kind of hokier aspects of
totally.
The story, by and large. The Disney parts, the corporate parts, the appeal to the widest possible audience factor of this kind of story. You know, whatever you want to call it, I think they do a really good job with it and really mitigate a lot of those potential pitfalls.
Yeah, despite my feelings about some of the predictableness of the storytelling, I think the performances are uniformly excellent.
Yeah.
I think everybody is great. So I'm actually going to go 70.
I was tempted to go 70. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, like the performances are not iconic, but everyone does a great job. Lake Bell has so many lines where I thought that is not an interesting line, but you made it interesting.
Totally.
Like when I think about the line on the page, I'm like, oh, that's actually maybe even sort of hard to make seem like a real interesting person.
Yeah.
But she does it. And like John Hamm was great at being a dick and then less of a dick eventually.
Yeah.
And Alan Arkin has the most preposterous premise in this movie, but he is always faultless.
Bill Paxton.
And I thought Asif Manvi was great. And I enjoyed the actor who played their assistant. Her name is Alan Rachel.
Yeah, I thought she was great because that character is such a device, really. And I think that she was able to make it more than that.
Totally.
Like, it is one of those, this role is mostly here to serve this specific function, no more, no less. But she really brought a lot of personality to it.
Yes, absolutely. But my favorite performances are really the Indian actors in this film, 100%.
They're wonderful.
Yeah, Peter Bash Tripathi as Amit, as you mentioned, Suraj Sharma as Rinku, and Madhur Mittal as Dinesh. And I mentioned earlier Darshan Jariwala as Vivek. He has a smaller role, but he's so excellent.
He's so good.
It's like the legibility of their thoughts, and the moments are so specific and their work is so spontaneous. And I might just be very biased by how lovable I feel like those characters are in the film, but I think it's more than that. There's something actually like completely fearless and full about their performances, where I feel like even technically excellent performances can be sort of minutely restrained, which is not to say that their performances are big, because they're incredibly nuanced and subtle. There's just something about like the amount of space that their hearts take up in their performance that, yeah, I almost can't explain it, but I watch it and I'm just like, what they do, that is what I want to do. I think I am nowhere close, but that's what I wish I could do.
And super valuable in a movie like this, especially, that does a good job, but there are moments where it does kind of walk a line where it's like, look at these cultural differences. And I think that everything they bring to it sort of helps to, I don't know, I feel like there are moments that with lesser actors could have almost come off as like problematic.
Yes, but do not at all but in this film, because yeah. They're just every so, moment is so full.
So full, exactly. Yeah.
So our next tool is delightfulness of catcher character. So the main catcher that we see is the catcher at USC, and he doesn't have any lines, but he is very put upon, and he is doing his level best to field balls that hit 10 feet in front of the plate, or scoot all the way to the backstop, or hit him in the shoulder. And so for sheer perseverance and never once complaining, which I feel like are admirable catcher-like qualities, I'm giving him a 40. I know he doesn't have any lines, and this is probably inconsistent of me, and 30 would be more appropriate for delightfulness, and maybe I'm setting a dangerous precedent, but he is there, man. He shows up. He does his freaking job when it is not easy to do. Respect.
I also went 40 for the same reason. Like, not much there, pretty much nothing in the way of personality, but patient with many wild, slow, weird pitches of Dinesh and Rinku. So that's good. And I think that is worth a reward.
Yes, I agree. And I am also relieved that I'm not a crazy person. What do you think about delightfulness of announcer?
I put a 30, and here's why. There you go. That's why. No, I went 30 for the reason of there isn't really much of an announcer. There is a guy who announces the pitches at the contest, but that's not really a game announcer. But in the like final contest in Mumbai, the like finals, he is there and he's like doing that job. It's not long, but he's there and he's doing it and it's okay. Also, a little bit cheating is in that same sequence where John Hamm and Alan Arkin and Asif Manvi are like watching the proceedings. Some of their lines are like basically announcer lines, where it's like, well, what does Rinku have to do to win the game? Well, he's got to throw like a 96 wild or above 84 and be a strike. Yeah, but it's definitely not going to be the 96. Yeah, and a strike under pressure is going to be hard. Like, the banter totally sounds very announcery.
Yes.
So again, like, I'm 30 because like it's not really the kind of announcing that we go for generally with this, but it's not nothing. And so, yeah.
Here's what I have to say to that. Good eye, Scout, because I just had a 20. I said there's no announcer, as there is no in-game play. However, if I'm going to score that guy's delightfulness, if I can cheat, speaking of cheating, I think I'd actually score him a 40. I think he's a 40 amount of delightfulness. I understand that you are maybe downgrading him because he's not an announcer in the way that we have generally expected an announcer to show up, which is why I literally didn't even think of him.
And it hurts because it's not a game.
It's not really a game. Yes, it's like doesn't really count. It's baseball almost.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'll go 20, sort of future value 40 if we're talking about that guy.
All right. Yeah, I like that.
And then for lack of misogyny, so phrased such that a higher score is a good thing, there are some microdoses of misogyny in this film, but I think that they're all portrayed negatively. So JB's character is presented, as we already groaned about, as being the type who only likes models,
mm-hmm.
as if Lake Bell is not model beautiful. And he dates a bunch of different women, but then he's surprised when Brenda has a date. It's the classic sort of like double standard.
Yeah, yeah.
But the movie is pretty clear in telling us that, like, this is not the way to be. So positive lack of misogyny points. And Brenda's character is smart, studying to be a doctor, but not self-serious and real. And I generally like her character. That too gives positive points. I don't super love this kind of like gender normative, her having no idea about sports things.
Right.
And instead being like, but I look at them as human beings and like you only see them as assets. Like just sort of that breaking down along gender lines, boring. But generally, I don't feel like I can necessarily call that misogyny.
Sure.
And then the other female character we talked about is the assistant at JB's agency. But she's like an actual character with some quirk. I think a lot of that is the performance. So overall, I feel like this movie does about as well as it can, given that the story is about a bunch of dudes. Like, my dream is if it could change Asha's character to a woman as like a smart, tough sports agent, you know, an Indian American woman who loves cricket. That would be more awesome.
And who has the idea.
And who has the idea.
Yeah.
That would be even better. But like, that would be 80 grade, I guess. I don't think it's doing anything exceptional here, especially for 2014. So I go 55.
Okay. I went a 60 for mostly the same reasons. It feels like it might be a little high, but I'll go ahead and stick to that. I think that Lake Bell is great, smart,
oh, totally.
Independent. Like, that character is awesome. Sense of humor, presented as someone with like a little bit more balance and wisdom than most of the other people in the world of the film, which is great. And despite my kind of irritation with her in that moment that I discussed earlier, the assistant
is Scotch moment.
No, the like, can't you understand that this is a serious thing to him, even if it isn't for you? And yeah, I think the only thing that's really holding it back is that there aren't very many women in this. Like,
for 2014, if this were like 1940 or 1970 and it had this number of female characters, it would have a higher score.
Yeah, maybe.
But like, in 2014, we should be doing better.
And like, the mom is great, Rinku's mom, and the assistant's great. But like, yeah, it kind of has a low ceiling as a result of that. There's not a whole lot there. There's like those three and the couple of women that we see JB dating who I think each have one or two lines, and it's in both cases them just like in his house, like post-coital basically, and like that doesn't help things.
Does not help things. No, as a matter of fact, it lightly hurts.
But yeah, I'd say all in all, above average, mostly based on the strength of Lake Bell's character.
I think that's very fair. So now we're going to move on to our next segment, the yogurt pie of segments. Yes or no? Would this movie be better with Kevin Costner in it?
Yes. I think, well,
No, defend your point.
This is a tricky one a little bit for me because I want to say yes, but I also think that like John Hamm is so great in this. But I think that Kevin Costner would also do well in that role.
I agree, but ultimately I think my answer is no, it wouldn't be better. Like, I would definitely watch a version where an appropriately aged Kevin Costner plays J.B. Bernstein, but I like John Hamm's performance, and I actually think that he's slightly better casting for the character than Kevin Costner is. I think Kevin Costner would do a fine job.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think there's a part of me that just feels like he makes sense in the world of this film, but mm-hmm. the film, whether you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, wherever you're at with the film, it's hard to deny that it's very well cast.
It is exceptionally well cast.
Yeah.
Yes.
I can see him in that role, but like, I kind of don't want to take John Hamm out.
Yeah, agree. Does this movie reference Babe Ruth?
I don't think it does.
No, it does reference old Biscuit Pants himself, Lou Gehrig.
Oh, that's right, because of
Pride of the Yankees.
But yeah, but otherwise, no.
So, segue to, is there a dog?
I can neither confirm nor deny that there is a dog.
I wonder if we have the exact same moment in mind.
This is at the Taj Mahal?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So JB is talking to Ash in front of the Taj Mahal, which is where one of the tryouts is happening. And he is describing it to Ash, and he's like, it's white, except for the part that's red, which is a pretty good line, I think. And then says, and there's a dog in the foreground. And then it cuts to a wide shot shortly thereafter, and there's some cows, and like you see the pitching setup on the other side. And then in the middle, it looks like there might be a dog there, but it's kind of hard to tell.
Yeah, he does specify in the line that it is a little dog. He says there is a little dog in the foreground, and perhaps that was them just trying to fudge whether or not you would see a dog.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you do not really see a dog, so it's sort of like the existential question, is the mention of a dog being there? Is that a dog?
Yeah. There's a part of me that just would have expected at least one moment in India to see a dog running around.
You do see like a goat and you see a cow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But no, you do not see a dog. I do not feel like we can fairly say to you, gentle listeners, that if what you need to do is see a dog, that you can watch this movie and be satisfied.
Yeah.
Are Yankees fans the main antagonist of this film?
No, they're not. What is it? Just not knowing how to play baseball, or baseball without fun, or what would you call the antagonist of this film?
I think one of the antagonists is the enemy agency, kind of.
Kind of.
Presented as an early antagonist. I think that the main antagonist is perhaps JB's own ignorance.
Sure.
And then it sort of becomes Chang. Kind of becomes the antagonist for a little while.
Yeah. But it's kind of a thing that I guess happens a little bit with a story like this, where it's like very early on, they set out to do a thing and then they do it. And like most of the obstacles are just related to the thing itself of like, oh, it's hard to find an unknown to teach a person a sport.
Yes.
On a professional level in a short amount of time.
Baseball is hard is the antagonist.
Yeah, but that's not really a villain, but that's kind of what it amounts to at the end of the day, I guess.
Yes. So our next segment is 6 degrees of baseball.
Yes. And what I have found here is that Gregory Allen Williams, who plays Doug, Tom House's assistant coach, plays a bullpen guard in Major League.
Well done.
So these are two kind of unglamorous roles, although I think that he makes the most out of his little bit of time in this film. Like, it's a wonderful little performance for having like two lines and like a minute of screen time. But yeah, I think he's from Des Moines.
Oh, I love that.
And he's got a great career. He's done a lot of really, really good stuff. The other thing that's worth mentioning is that John Hamm is, first of all, he's a huge baseball fan. He's a huge St. Louis sports fan in general. So I assume that J.B. Bernstein's a Dodgers fan, or they just wanted to sort of tell the L.A. story by having him have that Dodgers cap on throughout.
I mean, also,
it wouldn't have been John Hamm's choice is what I'm saying, because he's a big Cardinals guy.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, his character's like a real Dodgers fan type of a person.
But John Hamm was the narrator of a documentary called The St. Louis Browns, The Team That Baseball Forgot, which is pretty good. It's kind of, you know, done in that sort of like some talking heads and some footage and then the Ken Burns like panning over some photographs.
Old photographs, yeah.
Way. But it's good, and it's available on YouTube and worth watching.
Excellent. Very good. 6 degrees of baseball.
Thank you. Thank you.
In terms of favorite moments in this film, I'm going to mix it up and I'm going to go first this week.
Yeah, do it. Go first.
And my runner-up is when Asif Manvi and Alan Rachel's character high-five, but he's holding a coffee pot. And so she high-fives the coffee pot. And like, it's clear that she's not deeply injured, but like that it is hot. And yeah, it's just, it's a tiny moment, but it's delightful.
I like also that when that happens, it's actually Ash who says, ow.
Yes.
Like, or there's it, just like, something
he
very
says something like, oh, so, yeah, yeah, yeah. He like makes a sound. But my favorite overall sequence, it's the sequence when Rinku and Dinesh are at JB's apartment and they're watching reality TV.
The Hills specifically, I think.
I had no idea what it was. And some woman on that show is talking about Spencer asking her to move in. And Rinku says, no way, Spencer.
Yeah, that's really good.
It's so delightful. But I would like to continue to choose the entire sequence in which then the pizza guy comes and they're befuddled by it. And then JB comes in and is like, it's pizza. And then Amit is immediately like, you guys, it's pizza. Duh. Like, what's wrong with you? It's pizza, of course. And then Rinku says later when he's been eating the pizza, like, I think I've fallen in love with pizza.
I love everything
about that, except for just as a Phillies fan, dissing Spencer as a name is not necessarily a great look for people who are hoping for salvation from Spencer Howard.
I think for mine, I'm going to go with a scene that you brought up earlier, which is the car ride post Brenda hookup.
It's very delightful.
And the way that Amit and Dinesh and Rinku try to navigate it and are like kind of bashful, but like kind of excited, and the back and forth between them and JB, where he's like, because they're asking, like, are you gonna marry Miss Brenda? And he's like, no, that's not what you say in America. You ask, like, how far did you get? You know, like, did you kiss her or whatever? And they're like, whoa, no, well, that's private. And he's like, yes, exactly. And they're like, but did you kiss her? Everything about it is just really satisfying.
Did you have a least favorite moment?
I think it was the problem here is that we're not having enough fun parts of the film. Just generally, we're probably more than anything else the thing that made me kind of like roll my eyes and be like, this is entering into a territory that I am just not responding to as much. Like, it's kind of like making it into a slightly different movie from the parts of the movie that I like the most.
Yeah, I agree. And for me, I think my least favorite moment is them professing their affection for each other on the field right before the young men are about to pitch. It's just, I mean, I could pick almost any. No, that's not true. Some of the scenes from the lame romantic subplot are better than others. Like, there are many along the way that I just rolled my eyes at, but that was the worst one. Is there a scene that you'd like to see?
I guess I would have liked to see a little more training. I mean, honestly, some actual play would be nice. I understand why it can't really be in the movie, like the way that it's structured. And I understand that the movie is focusing on like John Hamm learning to shift his priorities. And so the popo hunt and the neglect of Rinku and Dinesh is part of that. But I wanted to see maybe a little more of Tom House helping the kids improve specific things related to their throwing. And also just them maybe understanding the sport of baseball a little bit more. There's that little scene with Amit where he's like quizzing them using the Baseball for Dummies book. Mm-hmm. And that's lovely, but it's so short. And I don't know, like, I think I would have been happy to have just a little bit more of that.
Yeah, I would have as well. And I definitely had the thought that when at the end of the film, you see a little bit of the footage of the real life Rinku and Dinesh in the Pirates clubhouse. It's 2014. Is there no footage of them pitching in a game in
right.
single A?
Yeah.
Like, that would have been the great thing to end the film with rather than ending it with the little Indian boy. I mean, again, I don't hate that sequence. It's just icing on the capitalist cake.
Yeah.
But like, I think that all of us who were thirsting for baseball would have been so grateful to see like some actual baseball play at yeah. that moment in the film.
Especially, yeah, I completely agree. Like, and you don't need to go all the way to, like, I understand why the movie sort of stopped when it did, particularly because, you know, like, Dinesh played for a couple of years and then went back to India. Like, he didn't do, like, super great. And Rinku was pretty good, but didn't ever make it past
A-ball. Well, he had to get Tommy John surgery.
He had Tommy John yeah. in 2014 and then broke an elbow, I think, in 2015 and has since become a professional wrestler. Do you know, in A-ball, he was teammates with Josh Bell.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I love that so much.
And I want to say in his Australian League play, which he did for a few years. Yeah. He played with Didi Gregorius and G-Man Choi.
That is very cool.
Which is pretty cool. So I understand like not going in 2014 to be like, and here they are now. Like Dinesh is in India and Rinku is not going to be playing this year because he's getting Tommy John. But like there was plenty of opportunity to show them pitching.
Yeah.
So I just agree with you, I guess.
Yeah. Although that was not the scene that I had in mind, but it is an excellent segue to the scene that I had in mind because I would like a scene with them and Cole Hamels, because apparently Cole Hamels was training at USC in the offseason at the same time that they were there.
Whoa!
So think about the added value in amount of baseball and baseball accuracy if only there were a scene with real or fictional Cole Hamels.
Nice. Yeah.
Yes. And I mean, I feel like, you know, they in the scene with all of the scouts, there are so many famous baseball luminaries. Like basically as background actors, there's like Tom Verducci and Jason Stark and my heroes Ken Rosenthal and Jeff Passan and my nemesis Bob Nightingale. They're all there. But it would have been great to have a real ball player in the film.
Aside from Curt Schilling, you mean?
Yes, Curt Schilling, who appears as a Baseball Tonight host. And we are going to just move right along.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So in maybe direct opposition to Curt Schilling, who is your dreamiest player?
Either of the choices are the right choice.
Uh-huh.
But it's Rinku for me.
Oh, okay. I think I'm leaning a little more towards Dinesh.
Okay. And I don't know if it's knowledge of the fact that like he kind of stuck with baseball longer has something to do with that.
Yeah.
But also he's a lefty. So being a lefty that can throw at that velocity obviously means that he gets a little bit of a bump because the game, obviously being a counterclockwise game, advantages lefty pitchers slightly.
For sure.
Oh, and also I meant to mention during baseball accuracy, and I can't believe that I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that increased my baseball accuracy score was the fact that, of course, Suraj Sharma is not a lefty.
Oh, he isn't?
No, he's not. But they flipped the tape.
What?
Yes. Like I read this somewhere or I heard it in an interview or something that they thought that it was important enough to make sure that Rinku Singh in the movie was a lefty that they had all kinds of like flipped lettering uniforms for him and they just reversed the tape on all of his footage where he's throwing.
They Pride of the Yankees'd him?
They Pride of the Yankees'd him.
And then they put Pride of the Yankees in the movie?
They did. They freaking love Pride of the Yankees.
Oh man, what a move.
Yes. But they did not Field of Dreams him, and that's what's the most important. And also, I think I really loved both of their characters as portrayed in the film, but he's portrayed as like a little bit more outgoing, and he's just very charming.
Yeah. I slightly wondered if some of the characters were like written to the knowledge of where they were in the present day. Like, I don't know. I was just thinking about the fact that Dinesh played for a couple of seasons and then went home. And he tends to be the one who's like, I miss home.
I read a few articles and obviously I can't quote them directly, but that seemed to suggest that he was pretty much homesick as soon as he got there. And it was always a little bit more of a struggle for him. Mm. Whereas Rinku kind of took to it, took to being in America slightly more. So the film definitely depicts that, I think.
Yeah.
And so I don't know to a certain extent how much of the articles might be reflecting that back a little bit. So I can't say for sure, but I do know that I read things that sort of corroborated that storytelling point. Did you have a favorite performance?
For me, as good as so many people are in this film, it's Bill Paxton, I think.
Oh, interesting.
As Tom House. I think it's funny. It's grounded, like a little offbeat. But I also just like miss his work so much. when I think about the kind of actor that I want to be like, he's definitely one of the names on the list. And I mean, he plays, we haven't really talked about it, but he plays such an interesting character. Tom House was a former major league pitcher turned coach. He had a pretty nice career pitching in relief in the 70s, though he's actually, one of the things he's remembered most for is that he was in the bullpen when Hank Aaron hit his record-breaking 715th home run, and Tom House caught that in the bullpen and then ran out to give the ball back to Hank Aaron. So you can actually pull up the picture and there's like this grinning Tom House like handing the ball over, which is pretty cool. And in his coaching career that came afterwards, he was a very early proponent of like more scientific advanced, yeah, like mechanics based things. He definitely was a godsend to Nolan Ryan.
Yeah, he like shouted him out in his Hall of Fame speech.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And also like worked with Randy Johnson, I think. He's more recently been doing work with a slew of like top tier NFL quarterbacks on their mechanics. So I don't know, like it's a really interesting character being portrayed in like a very nuanced and enjoyable way by really one of my favorite actors. So it's hard not for me to pick him.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent choice. I mean, I think that there is a feast of choices here.
Oh my God, yes.
But I think that my runner-up is Peter Bosch, who plays Amit. I think he's wonderful.
Oh, he's great.
I think he's so great. But I think my favorite performance is Suraj Sharma.
Yeah.
I just think he's wonderful.
I believe I could easily make either of those choices.
Yeah. 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 So I've talked about him a lot already. But yeah, I think that's my favorite performance.
Awesome.
So that does it for 1/326th of Garrett Cole, which is what we joked that Million Dollar Arm was going to be when we had not yet seen the movie. I would like to read a review from my friend Yancey Eaton, who writes, "Love this. The chemistry with these two is incredible. It's like they're married or something."
What?
Thanks, Yancey. You're the best.
That's very funny.
And if you would like to find us on the internets, my Twitter handle is @Ellen_Adair, and my Instagram is @EllenAdairG.
And I'm @EricGildy on both of those things.
Bringing it right back around. And next week, we are going to be talking about Angels in the Outfield.
That's right.
The 1951 film.
Ho-ho, a twist.
Ho-ho, yes. A twist, which we have never seen before.
This is the version with Janet Leigh and Paul Douglas. Yes.
And we're going to have some thoughts about it. Probably.
I hope so, yeah. Otherwise, it's going to be a boring conversation.
So please join us next week to find out whether or not it's a boring conversation.
Oh, it's going to be fun. We're going to get into it.
We're going to get into it. You know it.
Yeah.
You know it, y'all. All right. Talk to you next time.
Bye, guys. All ball.